we like to look at Charles Ives as our first iconoclastic, unique American voice. He is writing songs at the end of the 19th century. He is in Yale University. He's driving his teachers nuts because he's writing German songs and American songs, beautiful poetry, and there's always wrong notes. There's always wrong cadences. There's always sort of, and they're inevitably, even when he took German theater very seriously, and, you know, his Ich grohle nicht is so wonderfully ironic and powerful in its expression. But of course, it was in a musical language that the Horatio Parkers of the day just didn't want to hear about. He wrote some marvelous songs. He was actually quite against World War I until we entered it. And then it was, by God, we're going to support our boys. And he wrote some beautiful songs and even a couple of songs on What Women Text. And in that marvelous book of 118 songs published in 1922 on his own money for his own friends and completely unknown to the public for 35 years. So we can talk about this unique, amazing invention of Charles Ives just after World War I, but realize it wasn't until the late 40s and early 50s and people like John Kirkpatrick and quite frankly, even as late as Leonard Bernstein with the New York Philharmonic, the first playing of these amazingly, hardly understood symphonies and the celebration of this very contradictory life of Charles Ives. One of the reasons he's so uniquely American is because this is just a genius, unknown, unheard voice. Probably the most cataclysmic event in his life was the loss of his father, who had taught him his musical language and this musical audacity. One of his hobbies was to marching bands in different keys across themselves and hear this cacophony of sound. You know, he was fascinated by the idea of dissonance. He hated maudlin banality. He hated pop fad culture. So he made fun of it, or he tried to make it better. You know, he would take the Cary Jacob Bond song and turn it into a bit of an artful salon piece. He was as much a product of the salon, the beautiful living room where his mother served tea and the correctness of it all. And that was what he grew up in. And after all, he was a very successful insurance agent, came from a good family, made a good living, but at the same time was not willing to accept that that was what should be the norm. We should have a wider thought process. He was unfortunately deeply conservative and probably essentially homophobic. But most of the people in his day were as well. I think that there's this always pushing the envelope of audacity, sort of saying, well, but what if it isn't supposed to be so correct? Or what if it just set us a little bit on our left foot and on the right foot? Maybe that's a good thing for us. And he did that without measuring that publicly. He did that of his own volition, experiment, his own belief that harmony could function a different way, music could function a different way. Well, why can't it sound like that? Why shouldn't it sound like that? The hell with the rules. What happens if we just keep this tune so it's recognizable, but we put all this other stuff in it, which is actually the sound of the horn or the round of the street or whatever was in his mind to do this? This is, I think, very powerful. In his songs, he's the audible version of Norman Rockwell. He's taking caricatures and portraits and posters of American life in his time, and wonderful, sentimentally, in a good way, poetry of his daughter playing with her girlfriends, as well as reflecting at the end of his writing days, a song called Sunrise with a violin obbligato, completely inharmonic to the vocal line. We recognize Ives for the uniqueness that he is. And what I do love in this series of American is the trivia involved. There are a couple of anomalies that I still have to flesh out, and I'll offer them to us here now. The life of Mark Twain is fascinating, and he inspired some interesting music, especially an uncompleted beginning of an opera by Kurt Weill on his life. And Mark Twain's name was actually Samuel Clemens, but he was a riverboat driver, and he used the nautical term which measured the depth of the water that you were in by twains, and Mark Twain was actually saying that you could go down that path. So he saw himself as a kind of chronicler, and what he was observing in life of America was sociologically aware. The trivia that I like are three human beings that had very much the same arc of lifetime. Mark Twain a little bit earlier than Charles Ives and Arthur Farwell, but especially Farwell and Ives had so much to say about music as it represented real democracy, much the way the same that Walt Whitman would like to talk about music. very inspiring, but they had nothing to do with one another. And I still don't know what the relationship of Mark Twain and Charles Ives was. And to add to that would be Norman Rockwell, the great illustrator and artist of the time, all lived within 35 and 45 miles of one another. And the real wonderful thing is Charles' wife's name was Harmony. Isn't that wonderful? Her name was Harmony, Harmony Ives. Her maiden name was Harmony Twitchell. And Harmony Twitchell's mother's name was Harmony Twitchell. And John Twitchell was her father. And John Twitchell was the minister in the area of where Mark Twain and Charles Ives lived, who was Mark Twain's wedding minister, his funeral minister, the presiding minister of his daughters that died. This Twitchell family relationship to the Twain family and the Ives family is totally documented, but I have yet to find a picture or evidence that Mark Twain and Charles Ives sat down, had a cigar, and talked about anything. And I'm sure it must be there. And if somebody sees this and knows more than I, which is easily done, please do let us know. Now, one of the things about Arthur Farwell that is very interesting, nobody knows who Farwell is. I wrote a PBS script once, or at least an outline for it, called Finding Farwell, because there's so much about discovering the process of making music and inventing music and his whole printing press for American music, which he founded in 1903 and sold to Shermer's, which shut it down in 1907, was called Wawan. Now, the Wawan Press is one of the great first evidences of a very enlightened composer, arts individual saying, we need to preserve things that are truly uniquely American. And in this, you have a composer named Gilbert, you have composers named Loomis, you have Farwell's work, you have what is evidence of what is now called the Indianist movement, where composers went out to the Indian reservations and listened to their music and trying to take their ritual music and westernize it so that there would be an identification with a very foreign culture on our soil, the original culture on our soil, and try and make it into music elements that we would understand. Cadman did this, Farwell did this. There was a wonderful woman named Alice B. Fletcher who was the inspiration to the Lomax boys, who are the Lomax library within the Library of Congress is the most fundamental and significant folk music library in our capital, in our nation's history. So all these things are just starting to gestate and manifest themselves in the 30s. Farwell is traveling back and forth across the states. He's a very, very respected teacher. He's writing pageants for different communities as evidence of the democratic experience. He is the teacher of Roy Harris, who is one of the first unique, classical, conventional, as it were, voices. Then we start having these, you know, the academic versus the traditionalists, and I don't want to really go down all those paths, but it's also having a dramatic effect on songwriting. And the avant-garde, as it were, are coming up with very inventive ways of setting text, but it's not necessarily recognizable in an emotional way. And that's why the program Rediscovering Melody was invented, because actually as early as the 50s, there's another movement that Ned Roram represents and Samuel Barber represents, where melody is again cherished as an expressive way to set poetry. And it's interesting that both of those men, well, Samuel Barber is far more preoccupied with Irish poets, both immigrants to America, but especially the Irish poets still in Ireland. James Stephens, of course, Joyce. But Ned Roram is in the 50s deeply inspired and brings the whole world of transcendentalism seen through the eyes of Walt Whitman into song repertoire. And Ned Roram is certainly our most prolific 20th century iconic American song composer. And even he is starting to be forgotten. He's still alive. I've met him a couple of times. I admire him enormously. There's another academic but great voice for song called John Duke. And John Duke set many, many different poems, Rutka and Wallace Stevens, and certainly Emily Dickinson starts appearing. Emily Dickinson has pride of place with Copland very early. We're already now into the 40s and the 50s. Emily Dickinson was this rather unique poet. Of course, she was a woman, but her poetry is this deep internal tapestry of life without external evidence, if you will. Unbelievably inspired in efficiency of words to explode in one's imagination those various emotions we all have in solitude and observations of the relationship of life as a force or as a personality versus death as a force or as a personality. It's an amazing canon of literature. And she and Walt Whitman hold pride of place of the two most composed poets of our literary experiences.